On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats and check in on the status of the NBA MVP race. Is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander still the clear-cut favorite despite OKC's success without him on the court? And does Cade Cunningham have enough of a case for MVP? Can Wemby hang on for the rest of the season to even qualify for the 65-game minimum for MVP? And plus, Luka passed up that game-winning shot, passed that grenade to LeBron in a Lakers loss. Should we be concerned about Luka's legs? All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, 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 welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and that is our Dan Devine, your Dan Devine. Dan's back, baby. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for the warm welcome, Tom. And, you know, like all the cards, the heartfelt missives from our listenership during my week away. It was just a vacation. It was not, any kind of profound illness, but I do appreciate all the support all the same. I got to say, you go and you like go into the minor leagues and pluck up some guy named Windhorst to come in for second chair. I mean, really kind of a wild choice, if I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about a Wally Pipp situation here. It's some guy that he's just some rando. But he did okay subbing in for the big dog, Dan. So yeah, it was fun.
You are going to have to call me the big dog every once in a while from now on, because that felt real good. I did like the way I got a little sort of hot prickles all over my shoulders. Enjoyed that. And then number two, I got to say, the performance you put forward with me out of the lineup, I think it's going to reflect well on you come Most Valuable Podcaster Award season. And with that, I'm kind of ready to put up some numbers, Tom. So hit me with it. What is this week's big number?
This week's big number is 7-3. That's the Oklahoma City Thunder's record without Shai Gilgeous-Alexander this season. 7-3. And this is going to be the theme of the podcast, because we have what I like to call the MVP paradox. We're having a weird phenomenon this season where all of the MVP candidates, when they're off the floor, their team does as good and sometimes even better than when they're on the floor. So Shai Gilgeous-Alexander out with the abdominal strain. He was out since before the All-Star break. And the Thunder won again on Tuesday night, and they just keep racking up wins against pretty good teams, the Cleveland Cavaliers, the Lakers, the Raptors on Tuesday night. And they don't seem to be missing Shai Gilgeous-Alexander too much, right, with a 700 win percentage in those 10 games without Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Kaysen Wallace, awesome again. These guys, Isaiah Joe stepping up in a big way, Lu Dort hitting shots, which if there's any bellwether on this team, if Lu Dort is hitting shots, they're going to be a champion, right? But when Shai Gilgeous-Alexander hasn't been on the floor, I was kind of waiting to see, man, because how good he's been this season and the start that they got off and how he was carrying them without J-Dub. Without J-Dub and without Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, they've been pretty good, like really good. And if you look at like his overall resume for MVP, he's like the favorite, right? He's the favorite. Like, I think if you look at Vegas or sports books or prediction markets, they all say like he has a greater than 50% chance of winning the MVP race. But Dan, this is a weird case where you can't really say, hey, they're 7-3 without Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. How actually impressive is he in terms of a candidate? Well, I want to throw some numbers at you on the other candidates. The Pistons, without Cade Cunningham this season, are 5-1. The Boston Celtics are 5-1. Wemby, when he's off the floor, the Spurs have been great. 10-4 without Wemby on the floor. OKC, as aforementioned, 7-3. Jokic, 10-6 when he's not playing. The Denver Nuggets are 10-6. And the only one where it feels like of the top six MVP candidates, according to the sports books and prediction markets, the only one that has seen like a big step back is the Lakers without Luka Doncic. They're 500 this season, 6-6. So Dan, I know you've been on vacation the last week and you come back and you feel like, all right, I'm ready for the stretch run here. You know, MVP talk is in full swing. I feel like I have a pretty good grip on things. Did I just throw a wrench in all of your math that you're looking at and all of the candidacies and the material you're going to be pouring over the next couple months? And now you're like, wait, who is the MVP this season?
Yeah, immediate throwing away of all the relaxation. Just ball all that up, all that, those good vibes I accrued over the course of the last week. Chuck them in the nearest dumpster. It's time to get stressed out, everybody. I think that your point is valid. Like, I mean, it is a weird year in multiple ways, right? I think we've talked about it being feeling like a weird year in the, like, how open is the East? Everybody keeps forgetting about the Pistons. Yeah, but then the Pistons go out and they get sort of stuffed in a locker by the Spurs. And there's people are like, oh, right, that's why we say it's open. And, you know, you've got this guy has missed a chunk of time. Then, like, this guy misses a chunk of time. And it's been staggered. And so, like, you've had different people kind of nose up ahead in the races. And so I think it appeared heading into the All-Star break, like, well, this isn't kind of an open and shut case. It's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's award to lose. This guy never misses any games. And he's already got like a 300 or 400 minute gap on everybody, on Jokic. Giannis has already been he has missed too many games to be able to qualify. And the Bucks are, you know, struggling below the play-in tournament. Yeah, Luka's there, but also the Lakers are like around the 5-6 seed, and, you know, kind of what do you do with that? He's missed a bunch of games. You have all these, and I know you wrote about it at TomTheFinder.com, that kind of question of, with a 65-game rule really winnowing down the field potentially and putting us in a position where you might have to consider very different styles of players for the MVP award than we may have seen in recent years. I think there's a possibility that the missing, the sort of distribution of missed games and the distribution of how those teams have performed in those missed games winds up taking care of itself in the wash. And then you do wind up sort of just going back to individual player resume, weirdly enough. Or it forces you to go to that sort of next level of it. Like, yes, their record when these guys are have not been available to play is whatever it is. What about how the teams perform when they are on the court versus when they are off the court? You know, what are we talking about in terms of on-court net rating, on-court efficiency differential, those sorts of swings? And that could wind up being kind of
size.
Yes, you have many more minutes and many more games for those discussions. But I do think it's instructive because you wind up, every year we wind up having to make different kinds of arguments for MVP candidates. Well, this guy's, you know, got he's the league's leading scorer. He's the best player on the best team. Well, this guy is head and shoulders above everybody else in these various advanced stats. Well, these other sort of more adjusted plus minus based stats say X, Y, or Z about this. You average it all out. What does it tell you? Well, right. But then we're talking too much about the analytics and not enough about on-court record. And so this year, it does feel like I'm not sure exactly what the arguments we'll wind up having to make are. I think if Shai winds up on the right side of 65 games, there won't be very many arguments we need to make. But there is a very good chance that we wind up having to have some pretty uncomfortable conversations if we have some, you know, another ding here or scratch and scrape there down these final 6-7 weeks of the season.
Yeah, this is, I think, one of the more underrated storylines going into the playoffs here is we're going to be talking a lot about MVP campaigns and their case going forward. But a lot of them, it's going to be compromised by the fact that they're missing a bunch of games. And this is the 65-game rule discussion that I really, really dislike about how the NBA implemented this rule in response to Joel Embiid and Kawhi Leonard missing a bunch of games and basically saying, hey, what if we hold this carrot out of you will only be eligible for postseason awards, MVP, Defensive Player of the Year, All-NBA, if you play at least 65 games. And I always thought that was going to backfire, that so much of the conversation of how good these guys are and their candidacy is going to be marred by how many games they've missed. And instead of how good they've been, we're focusing mostly on, are they actually going to qualify? And here you have it from the article. Jokic has one game left. And then if he misses another one, he's disqualified. So, right, like we thought that he was invincible, and then he hyperextended his knee and he was out for 16 games. Wemby's got 4 games left because we're actually counting Again, very confusing. This is going to be like the most confusing the NBA Cup final race. Right? The NBA Cup final does count for his 65 game count, but it doesn't count for any of his player stats. Luka Doncic has 5 games left that he can miss. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander through game 60 already ruled out. There's another game left before we reconvene and reevaluate and see if he's going to play in the next game. But he's going to, through 60 games, have only 66 games left. Sorry, 6 games left that he can miss before he's DQ'd. And Cade Cunningham, like, he has a leg up on all these guys in the terms of the candidacy because he can miss at least 10 games and still be eligible for the award. Jaylen Brown, also, if you want to count him in this, and a lot of Celtics fans got angry that I did not have Jaylen Brown on this chart, Dan. Of course, sure. You can't make anyone happy, everyone happy in this. But Jaylen Brown also just missed a game on Tuesday night, and the Celtics had a huge win without Jaylen Brown. So it confuses all of this even more that right when we think, okay, Jaylen Brown is ascending and making himself a real contender for this MVP award, then the Celtics go and win another game without him. And so this is where we're at, where we should be celebrating these guys about how good they are and how, you know, over the course of 60, 65 games, 70 games, this is how good they are. But when we do this math, typically we've said, hey, Jokic, when he's off the floor, the Nuggets are a disaster. He's MVP.
Right.
And that lever that we used to be able to pull for a lot of these arguments, I just can't look at any of these and say, you know what, actually, they're so good because look at what happens when they're gone. The with or without you, U2 effect, it just isn't there for a lot of these guys. So I think in your point, we're going to have to shift the conversation back to, all right, well, what happens when they're on the floor? How good have they been on the floor? Rather than saying, hey, they've been carrying this team because look at how awful they are when they've gotten injured. All these teams, I mean, we could have a larger discussion, another point, about what this says about the state of the NBA and coaching and the three-point shot, that the variance that these MVPs in the regular season, are they that valuable? That I think the stat, I have it here, without these 6 guys on the floor, these teams are a collective 43-21. That is a 55-game win pace. I'm going to repeat that. Without any of these MVPs on their respective teams this season, they're a collective 43-21, which is a 55 win pace over an 82-game season. So it just it throws into a wrench the word valuable, like value and most valuable player award. We used to be able to say, hey, one way to key in on this is to show when you're off the floor, your team crumbles, right? Not the case this year. So Dan, it's right now, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is about 60% odds to win the MVP, and we'll see what the report is after this game, through game 60 on Thursday night, what his status is. But as we creep towards the postseason, and the Thunder have 4 more games in which they're going to be on the second night of a back-to-back after Thursday, how much he's going to be playing in those games down the stretch, because I think they're going to be fending off the San Antonio Spurs. And as we've seen from those matchups, I think the Thunder are going to want to win every game out from here on out.
Yeah, there's no doubt that we'll move into sort of the next part of the conversation in a minute. But the thing that you brought up about, yes, this was the player participation policy and the 65 game rule, these were brought to bear as a result of certain star players and their teams having load management plans, right? We feel like we don't say those words very much anymore, but that phrase, load management, was, you know, like a curse in the NBA for a couple of years there. And it was the topic on the lips of decision makers and league office personnel. And it was something that we all had to talk and write about quite a bit. And it led to the institution of these rules. And now a couple years down the line, we are seeing some potential serious unintended consequences. We've seen some already, right? Where certain guys become ineligible for all NBA categories, costing themselves $10, $20 million as a result of that. Because if they had been eligible to be voted on by the writers and the folks that make those choices, they might have made the teams, but they didn't. So the contract escalators that they have for making certain awards, they don't access them. And so they lose out on money. And that is a situation that nobody wanted. And certainly the people making the votes, as one of them, don't want. But it's one that the league, in trying to solve one problem, created a couple of other ones. And I think that's maybe worth thinking about as we've just come off of a pretty heated few weeks of discussions about how the league's going to solve the tanking problem. Let's just put a pin in that idea and maybe revisit that conversation in a couple of years and see if maybe we haven't found a couple of ways in which that watertight idea sprung leaks that we didn't see coming. These things can happen, and they can wind up with some pretty significant downstream effects. And in this case, I mean, the positive spin is it will make this MVP race interesting in a way that maybe some of the other ones haven't been, where it's like, it's two dudes and that's it. And so this year there will be a maybe wider array of discussions to have, which is, that can be a good thing. Although, as you mentioned, you can't make everybody happy, and sometimes you can't make anybody happy in a conversation like this. So well, it remains to be seen how those conversations go.
Well, the other thing here, and you kind of hit on it, is the idea of the negative externalities, the unintended consequences of the 65-game rule. And as we saw Tyrese Haliburton last year and Jason Tatum and Damian Lillard go down with catastrophic injuries, what you hear from teams is the risk is that you're going to force guys, in order to be eligible for these awards, play in games when they had an outsized injury risk on the second night of a back-to-back, for example, or if they're really hurting, but hey, I'm on game 64 and I need game 65. I'm going to play even though long-term this is probably a bad idea, so that I can get those awards that are important to me that the NBA has created trophies for. It's obviously a thing that the NBA wants to incentivize players to win these awards, these trophies, and the celebrations of these players through these awards. And will that backfire in the postseason when obviously everyone says the games matter more? And this is when the actual real legacies are drawn up, is in the postseason. And if these kind of players are getting run down at the end of the regular season just to get these awards, you don't want that. You don't want that. And so that's it's going to be really interesting as Shai Gilgeous-Alexander works his way back from this abdominal strain, which I feel like the elephant in the room is the guy who's got the most wiggle in the NBA and the shiftiness, stop and go, and contorting his body for all these crazy shots that he hits. These circus shots, you need your abdominal core. I don't begin to even think about how strong that guy is, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, right, and how wiry he is and how much strength he has in that core to just basically wiggle his way out around the floor. That's going to be a huge, huge variable going forward. Forget about J-Dub for a second, but the Thunder need to get him back. But they also got to weigh this award thing that, who knows, maybe Shai Gilgeous-Alexander just does not care about becoming a reigning two-time MVP. But it's something to watch. And I know that there's other candidates here that deserve praise and deserve some more focus on what they've done this season. So coming up right after the break, Dan, we're going to get your three little numbers about the most interesting MVP storylines that are kind of tickling your brain and not stressing you out after your vacation. So Dan, nice, rest up, because after the break, we're going to hear your three little numbers. All right, Dan, 7-3. That's the big number this week. That is the record of the Thunder without Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, trying to go for his second MVP. Back-to-back MVPs, we'll see when he gets back and how well the Thunder continue to do without Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in this MVP paradox season. Dan, what is your first little number here talking about the MVP combo?
Well, yeah, you know, in our first segment, we talked about the idea of trying to just wrestle with who these guys are on the floor, right? As opposed to making the case, because if the teams are doing well with them off the floor, you know, how do you sort of weigh in? I think we mentioned Cade Cunningham as kind of like the stopgap alternative for if guys miss games. And I think it's worth looking at just like, well, what is Cade Cunningham's on-court case, right? So our first little number is 48.3. That's how many points per game this season Cade Cunningham is creating, whether by his own scoring or assisting on his teammates' baskets. That's according to databaller.com. 48.3 points per game is third in the NBA, behind only Nikola Jokic and Luka Doncic, and just ahead of SGA, which feels like pretty good company for an MVP conversation. Here's Cade's resume. best player on far and away the number one seed in the Eastern Conference, the Detroit Pistons. He's got great counting stats. He's about to become just the fifth player ever with multiple seasons averaging 25 points, 9 assists, and 5 rebounds per game. It's Oscar Robertson, Nikola Jokic, LeBron James, Russell Westbrook, and it's about to be Cade Cunningham. Pretty good company there. Some MVPs in that list. He runs a top 10 offense for the Pistons. I don't know that anybody expected the Pistons to have a top 10 offense, and they score like a top 3 offense when Cade's on the floor compared to a bottom 5 offense when he's off the floor. So going back to that sort of, as we mentioned, that like old way of thinking about things, they are much better with him on the floor than off it on the offensive end of the floor. And he's been a clutch time killer, fourth in the NBA in total clutch points, shooting 50% when the score is within 5 points in the final 5 minutes. So you've got like that points created stat. He leads the league in true usage. He's got a huge usage rate. He's on the ball all the time. He's become kind of like a Jokic or Luka level engine, like heliocentric engine for that Detroit offense, while also being a positive defender on the league's second best defense.
Yeah.
And yet, when you look at the impact stuff, the adjusted plus minus base metrics that we talked about, dunks and threes estimated plus minus, Cade's 8th. Jeremias Engelman's XRAPM, regularized adjusted plus minus, 18th. Synergy's SPI, 19th. Darko daily plus minus, 19th. Win shares per 48 minutes, 19th. There's a disconnect there, right? And the box score stats and the narrative case and the kind of the stuff that we, that, and it's, and I don't say narrative is a dirty word, like best player on best team, you know, guy elevating them to the number one seed. That's real stuff. And then there's this advanced metrics case that kind of looks more like an all NBA case than an MVP case. And I think that is, to me, one of the most interesting questions in this whole thing. Like, why is there that disconnect? Where is the gap for someone like Cade Cunningham between what we see in the box score and what we don't see in those impact numbers?
Yeah, it reminds me some of like the Derrick Rose year, where a lot of the reason why Derrick Rose's story was so incredible, and the fact that the Chicago Bulls got that number one seed instead of the big three in Miami, and how electric he was on the floor offensively. But the reason why they were so good and a 60-win team was because the defense, right? Tom Thibodeau's defense was outstanding that season. And the same thing with the Pistons, where the reason why they're as good as they are, and you mentioned them being a top 10 offense, but the reason why they're as good as they are is because they're the second best defense in the NBA. Jalen Duren, Isaiah Stewart, Asar Thompson, I think are heading of this three-headed monster for the Detroit Pistons defensively, why they're able to be as good as they are. But that's not very sexy. You know, it doesn't really come up and be able to lead First Take, for example, on like, hey, this Pistons team is awesome. That defense from Asar Thompson late down the stretch was the big reason why they won the game. You rarely hear that in the big headlines, but it's easier. And I think a lot more intriguing to just point out, Cade Cunningham had 40 points and 13 assists in that game. Incredible. Not to say that that's not incredible, but the reason why the Pistons are where they are is a big chunk of that is that defense. And Cade Cunningham also is not the most efficient guy. He's, you know, his shooting metrics are not outrageous and MVP caliber. It's not Jokic. It's not Shea Gilgeous-Alexander. And so it's in that kind of Jaylen Brown territory where he's a high volume scorer. And who was it? It wasn't, what was the 5 of 26 against the Spurs? A GTA release date was, I think, what someone called it in my mentions. I saw concert dates is funnier, but GTA release date is also great. But these, you know, high volume 5 of 26 shooting, he had blocked 6 times in that game. He's never been blocked more. So coming off that article that I wrote about how he might be the presumptive MVP and he should be way more likely to win it, he goes out and it was not one of his best games. I'll also point out here, Dan, that yes, the Pistons are 5-1 without Cade Cunningham in uniform, which is outstanding, obviously. It's only 6 games. And in those 6 games, those two of those wins were against Chicago. They had a win against the Pelicans, and they also had a win against the Indiana Pacers and the 76ers. Not the strongest competition to have a 5-1 record against. So there's a lot of variables here that are complicating the case for Cade Cunningham. If you want to make the case, you say, look at that. He's played more and he's created more points for his teammates through scoring and assists. And that is a very compelling argument. The efficiency, the fact that they're 5-1 without him in uniform also kind of complicates that picture of how valuable he is to this team. It's a really cool story, but it does remind me a lot of that Derrick Rose year in 2011, where this ascendant team takes over that number one East spot away from where I think we were expecting this team to be. And the defense is really the biggest driver of that. But Cade Cunningham will also deservedly get a lot of the credit for how they're doing.
For sure. And it's interesting you brought up during that discussion, like it's their sort of a Jaylen Brown thing, because our second little number this week is -7.9. And that is the on-court, off-court differential this season for one Jaylen Brown, according to NBA.com. And so here's what that means. More than 1,700 minutes Jaylen Brown has played this season. And when he's on the court, the Boston Celtics have outscored opponents by 5 points per 100 possessions. That is a good, perfectly respectable, solid mark. In nearly 1,000 minutes with him off the floor, they have annihilated opponents by 12.9 points per 100 possessions, which is not merely respectable and solid. That's like last year's Thunder KD-era Warriors level net rating. And so you have that -7.9 swing when Jaylen Brown leaves the floor or is on the floor. And that seems odd, right? Because again, like Jaylen Brown is having the best season of his NBA career, 29.2 points, 7 rebounds, nearly 5 assists per game. His rebounding percentage, his free throw rate, his assist rate, all up career highs. Luka level usage rate, like such a huge workload. Nobody has taken more shots per game in the NBA than Jaylen Brown this season. And he's been like good to great finishing at the rim and shooting from mid range. Like he has been the unquestioned number one option on a Celtics team that has the second best offense in the NBA and the fourth best record in the NBA. And that everybody expected was going to fall apart after Jason Tatum went down and after they traded away Drew Holiday and Kristaps Porzingis and Al Horford goes. And like they lose half their team and instead they're awesome again. And Jaylen Brown is scoring 29, he's putting up 29-7-5 on, you know, good shooting numbers for him. And yet they've been so much better when he's off the floor. Again, we have that disconnect. What we see is that dude is the number one option on every play for them all the time, and he's scoring lights out and putting up the best playmaking numbers of his career while also being a good defensive player on the wing on a really good defensive team. So then why is the point differential so much better when he's off the floor? Like where's the gap?
This is one of those things. I'm so glad you're hitting on this because it's a real fly in the ointment for this candidacy where it's just like, all right, well, we got to unpack this and figure out why is it that, on Tuesday night, another instance of without Jaylen Brown on the floor, they go out and smoke the opponent. And it's like, okay, well, when we're seeing Jaylen Brown, do the things he does on both ends of the floor, guarding the opposing best player, like taking on those assignments. And then when he leaves, they go and they smoke the Phoenix Suns by 16. And look, the Suns are down. Like they got no sure. Devin Booker, no Dylan Brooks. I think the stat that we did on the broadcast for the Blazers game was the largest decrease in points allowed in Blazers history because they gave up 157 to the Nuggets on Friday night. And then on Sunday against the Suns, they gave up 77. So it went from 157 wow. allowed to 77 allowed against the Phoenix Suns. So that 80 point gap was the largest we had ever seen for the Portland Trail Blazers. And it speaks to how that offense for the Phoenix Suns is dreadful. So maybe if Jaylen Brown was out there on Tuesday night, they would have won by 40 instead of 16. But time and time again this season, and in that 6-game sample size, the Celtics are 5-1. It's not enough of a sample size to discredit or disqualify Jaylen Brown from the entire conversation, but it certainly is something worth digging and drilling down deeper, which I'm sure as we get down later into the season to try to figure out, like, what happens? Why is it that this happens with the Boston Celtics? And you can't just say this is analytics, Like, you can't just say this is just made up. Like, this is the scoreboard. There's nothing more fundamental in basketball than the scoreboard. And the fact of the matter is that scoreboard for the Boston Celtics is a lot more in the Celtics' favor when he's off the floor than when he's on the floor. And that's not everything. There could be some wonky three-point shooting in there. There could be some weird opponent strength, the lineup strength when you're looking at when he's out of the game and the second unit for the Celtics is so strong. I think they have the second most points out of the bench players in the NBA, and Peyton Pritchard is a big part of that. That creates some of that wonkiness, that dissonance between, hey, he's an awesome player scoring 30 points a game, so why is it that they're better without him? Well, a part of that is the bench units for Boston is so strong this year. And so it is tough because the story of the Celtics season is without Jason Tatum, they haven't really skipped a beat. And a big reason why is Jaylen Brown. But maybe we deserve to crown a lot of the credit to that the supporting cast also stepping up in big ways.
And I think a fair amount of that might wind up going to Joe Mazzulla when we get to Coach of the Year discussions at some point, because you look at structurally what they've built, where it's and it kind of leans into some of the things that Jaylen Brown does really well. Like, he can create his own shot. He's been creating at from the mid-range and at the rim, like, more than he's ever done before. And what those possessions lead to is, like, they lead to a true outcome. He's either going to make the shot, miss the shot, draw a foul. He's not going to turn the ball over as much, right? And low turnover is, like, Boston's number one thing. They lead the league in the lowest percentage of their possessions that result in a turnover, lowest turnover rate in the NBA. That combined with the way that their bigs offensive rebound, like, no, Nemish Keita and, Luka Garza and the rest of their bigs, they're not Al Horford and Kristaps Porzingis and what those guys were, Luke Kornet were, but they attack the offensive glass, the way they crash from the corners, like, they gobble up possessions and don't give them back. And so, like, the structure of what Mazzulla has built, and as you mentioned in that our first segment, the three-point variance of, like, jacked up three-point rate, it's a team that fires at, like, not indiscriminately, but Mazzulla ball has been predicated on, we jack up the three-point rate, we don't necessarily need to play fast, but we're going to make sure our potential expected outcome is a higher level of points per possession than you, and we're not going to give you easy stuff. Transition defense, elite, not giving you easy fast break opportunities. And so they, like, the whole system around Jaylen Brown is, like, watertight. And then he is in the middle, like, soaking up everything else. And the result has been an elite team. And so, like, I think you're right to say, like, maybe goes back again to that Derrick Rose example of, does he wind up being the beneficiary of, you know, the fact that nobody can quite evaluate how good Derek White is, right? Or those sorts of things, like the entire rest of the development of Keita and Baylor Shireman and everybody else on that team winds up in this, like, monster team. It's so wild, but it might wind up being the case. So it's like an individual player that winds up getting a collective level of respect could wind up being the case there. I think it's interesting to look at, like, why the Celtics are this good and how much is Jaylen Brown a part of that. I think it's a really interesting angle to look at as we go forward here. But now I'm yammering. Our third and final little number here this week is 44%. Those are the odds as of Wednesday morning that Mike Bowie at Unpredictable.com gives the San Antonio Spurs of finishing with the Western Conference's number one seed, the top spot in the West, 44%. I'm guessing by your response to that you had the same reaction that I did, which is it kind of blew my hair back when I saw that this morning. In
what
fairness,
beautiful hair that is. Yes, go ahead.
Oh, continue. Thomas, thank you so much. That and the big dog. Mm-hmm. I'm getting the prickly big warm dog feelings. It's very nice. not everybody is as sanguine on San Antonio's shot at number one as Mike is. Dunks and threes gives them about a 5% shot of finishing first ahead of Oklahoma City. Basketball Reference puts them at just under 10%. So, like, obviously a gap there. But Mike's team rankings that are based on his analysis of betting market information are really bullish on San Antonio down the stretch here. They enter Wednesday's matchup with the Raptors at 41-16, three games back of Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City has the West's second toughest remaining schedule, according to Tankathon. Yep. The Spurs are sixth. Their opponent's total winning percentage the rest of the way is, like, just above 500. The Spurs have won nine straight. They have the NBA's best record since the start of December. If the Spurs pull this off, does this thing maybe just become Victor Wembanyama's award to lose?
Yep. If they get the number one seed, it's Wemby. I mean, I don't think it's even a question. If they get the number one seed in the Western Conference, it's going to be Victor Wembanyama. Can I just also mention that with Wemby on the floor, in the month of February, the offensive rating for the Spurs is 126. That's like peak Jokic Denver Nuggets. 126 with Wemby on the floor and a 101 defensive rating. That's like an 80 defensive rating 20 years ago. 101 defensive rating in the year 2026 is absurd. So with Wemby on the floor in the month of February, during this 9-game win streak, it's plus 25 with him on the floor and plus 1.3 with him off the floor. There is no paradox here with Victor Wembanyama as of late. He's been outrageously good. Outrageously good. And the weird thing is he's fourth on the team in minutes. And so as he's getting better from the calf strain, I think you're going to see his minutes climb a little bit. As you saw against the Pistons, played, I think, 35 minutes. As he ramps up towards playoff shape and coming further away from the calf strain, I think you're going to see more Wemby, not less, at a time that maybe teams might ramp down with a guy who's dealing with calf strains. If they're going to be having this chase for the number one seed, if Shai Gilgeous-Alexander again is dealing with this abdominal strain and is not 100% or not playing, and if he is playing, maybe not close to 100%, we'll see. But I think that I wouldn't peg it at 44% as what the gambling markets might suggest on Mike Bowie's his formula, but I would say it's probably a higher chance than 5%. I would probably go closer to 15-20% chance that we see the Spurs, because of the tiebreaker rules also, that if it's a tie at you know, say 60 wins apiece, the Spurs are going to win the number one seed. And in that case, Wemby at this age is going to be an MVP. It's going to be really tough if they win the number one seed in the Western Conference to argue that it's not Wemby.
And again, that's, 65 game rule permitting, right? But if and when that happens, I'd like to, if the court reporter can go back and read the review, the document there, I'm pretty sure that back in the middle of October, we had a conversation about this very topic. And Emmy and Sarah, if you could just roll that, please.
Dan, this week's big number is 13. That's the number of post-ups we've seen already from Victor Wembanyama this preseason. Ooh. He hasn't done this before. He is a guy last season that, according to Synergy Sports, he ranked 19th in post-ups per game. And so the fact that he's doing this more than anybody this preseason is very notable. And it's a big reason why I think he's going to win MVP this year. Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
This number right here is a big reason why 13, I am picking
13 post-ups has you ready to make that call. So here is, I would like to say, I'm very sorry to the Wembanyama family, for my skepticism, for being uncertain about the possibility that those 13 preseason post-ups could be predictive in the way that they clearly have been. But more than anything, what I'd like to say is, if you doubt Tom Haberstroh's ball knowledge, you should know that he sees the future. Because here we are, and it's late February, and there's a coming up on a coin flip shot, apparently, for the Spurs to get the number one seed and for Wemby to go sprint the closing kick to win this award. So I think you deserve a little bit of credit for that. Maybe Victor Wembanyama a little bit more, but still, you some.
Yeah, I also said Reed Shepard was going to win Sixth Man of the Year, so that also has to be.
Those tapes have been deleted. It's weird that you mentioned that. I don't remember anything about that. That's no other predictions or projections have been saved in our system, but that one we were able to recall. It's lucky that was saved from the server fire.
Yeah, but that was a big storyline, right? The Wemby more migration towards the basket, where this season his average shot distance went from 17 feet away from the basket last season to now 12 feet away from the basket. So he's cut it down by a third, and a lot more at the rim. I think I have the numbers here that 20% of his shots were inside 3 feet last year, and now it's 31%. He's cut down on his three pointers. His efficiency has gone way up. And I think when you have De'Aaron Fox and Stephon Castle and now Dylan Harper, it's easier to live on Wemby Island, at Wemby MVP Island, when they've got such great young players around them. And I thought with more efficiency and getting closer to the basket and being like, oh, I'm 7'15", I should be living into the paint. Let's go live there for a lot more. I felt like, hey, this could be his year. So look, I don't see him winning MVP unless they get the number one seed, because I think round numbers and those accomplishments really swing the conversation and tip the scales. But man, he's been outrageous. And the statement that he did on Monday night against the Pistons, it was an MVP statement for sure. I think if you even look at like what Cade Cunningham's MVP case and the chatter before that game to after that game, you can directly point a line to Stephon Castle, Area 51, and Wemby, what they did to Cade Cunningham. And it seems like the whole conversation has changed even in the last 3 days.
Yeah, and that's the sort of unspoken thing here, is that now that we are past the Super Bowl and past the, you know, the college football playoff, like we're into the weekend, marquee games and the national TV broadcast and all that kind of stuff. We're going to have a lot more of those, flashbulb moments for people to see and then render their previous judgments completely irrelevant and, you know, turn on a dime and shift them and change their cases. And so we're going to see a lot more of that back and forth over the course of the next 6 weeks or so. But I think that he is in an awfully strong position to be able to make those cases. There's going to be a lot of eyeballs on the Spurs. There's going to be a lot of eyeballs on that race atop the West. And, that guy, you can't take your eyes off him. So there's a decent chance that a lot of people are going to be pretty impressed by what he puts together down the stretch. And it'll lend itself to that longer, like, most interesting, most weirdest possible MVP race that we've had in a while. Why not have an alien at the top of it?
Yeah. You know, there's one MVP candidate we haven't really talked too much about in this episode, and that's Luka Doncic. Got something to talk about here on Tuesday night with the last second shot and the weirdness of this season and the complaining to the referees. I think we're going to have to talk about the LeBron Luka Doncic loss down the stretch against the Orlando Magic. We're going to do that here coming up out of the break, Dan. We have lots to get into here. Surely this will come up in any sort of Luka Doncic is going to win the MVP discussion, is what the heck happened in the final seconds of that Tuesday night loss to the Orlando Magic, where it was 6 seconds left. They do this like kind of football play to run down the floor, which we've seen from Rick Carlisle and the Pacers, and it's worked. But then Luka Doncic just kind of had this brain fart and had a wide open shot that he has taken 1,000 times. And he decides to dribble in awkwardly, get this like a lot of contest, let Paolo Banchero get in front of him. And then he just hands this flaming grenade over to LeBron, who does this fadeaway, just chucks a shot just in the vicinity of the basket. Of course, LeBron is going to get the 0-for-1 on that in his clutch resume. And Luka Doncic just, I don't know what happened. He's short circuited on that play. I don't know what was going on. Dan, what was your first reaction to this just a weird finish to this game?
Yeah, honestly, the first thing it made me think of was like, what, 3 years ago after Kyrie Irving got traded to Dallas, and when Luka and Kyrie were in kind of like late game crunch time together and they were playing hot potato, like it was almost like they were being too kind to one another. Nobody wanted to step on the other guy's foot. And then they just like passed the ball up around and they lost to the Timberwolves because no one got a shot up at the end of the game. Except that was like, I think the game that I'm thinking of, that Timberwolves game, was like the first or second time that Luka and Kyrie had played together. And right, LeBron right. and Luka have been teammates for a full year now and have played like 60 games and 1500 minutes together or something like that. And it still sometimes looks awkward. But that's kind of it, right? That like, the idea of what the Lakers would be when you paired Luka Doncic with LeBron James and then to another extent Austin Reeves, it's been the theory has yet to really bear out in practice, right? Like, it just hasn't been as good as you wanted it to be. In those 1,489 minutes with LeBron and Luka on the floor together, LA's minus 86. Their offense has been like good, but not elite, more like seventh or eighth kind of an offensive efficiency in those minutes.
Is that since last year, you're saying?
That's going back to last year, and that's including playoffs. Yeah. It's including like, so this is from pbpstats.com. All competition, but from when Luka got there last in February of 2025 to now, 1,489 minutes minus 86. And the defense has been bad and the offense has been like good, but not great. And that's like kind of what it's, I mean, the record has been better than the underlying indicators. And that was true last season. And it's true now. It's been true all this season. But the funny thing is like the clutch time performance earlier in the season was what was really buoying the Lakers in their case. And now like in clutch time, they couldn't get the shot off. I think the thing to me, and like, I'm interested in what you think about this. When Luka was asked about what he saw in that last possession, kind of what went on, here was his quote. "I know I was open, but I just thought I was a little bit far. Tried to take one dribble closer, probably shouldn't have picked up the ball. I should have attacked. That's on me." And when he said, "I just thought I was a little bit far," that kind of set off a bell in my head. Are we worried at all about Luka Doncic's legs?
I know.
Yes, that is a far shot, right? That's a long way off where he pulled up from. That's like, you know, maybe 28, 29, 30 feet out. But we've also seen Luka pull up from that far and a lot farther without much compunction at a lot of points in his career. But then you kind of look at you get under the hood. Luka's drives per game have been down every year since 2021, declining year over year over year. This year, 14.1 drives per game, career low. Share of Luka Doncic's shots at the rim, 14% this year, career low. He has taken more shots from 28 plus feet out this season than anybody but LaMelo Ball, Stephen Curry, and Tyrese Maxey, and he's shooting 26.9% on those super deep threes. Luka's numbers are nuts. His individual production is great. The impact numbers consistently have him, you know, top five or so, top three, top five in the NBA. I think there's something to be keeping an eye on there. Like, Luka, the version of Luka Doncic with which we are familiar has like boundless confidence in his ability to get that shot off and take it and get it where it needs to go. And then there with the game on the line, the chance to win it, he says, "I thought I was a little far." It just feels notable to me.
Yep. Also notable. Skinny Luka, you know how many dunks he's had this season?
No. How many?
Zero. Has not dunked yet this season.
Does feel like we're a long way from the men's health cover, right?
Yeah, it does feel like that. like kind of feel like that is 6 years ago. The whole he's in the best shape of his career. Look at all the weight he's lost. He's going to move around like a rookie Luka Doncic, who had 14 dunks as a rookie, as a 19-year-old in the NBA. And that went from 14 to 9 to 5. Now we had one in a Laker uniform last season and zero in a Laker uniform this year. So there's that. The other side of that that you mentioned is that he takes deep threes all the time, right? So the idea that in this moment he decided to shy away and he didn't have the legs underneath him, that it was too far, I will remind people that he has three buzzer beaters in his NBA career. The distance on those buzzer beaters, according to basketballreference.com, 25 feet, 26 feet, and 27 feet away, okay? So he's had this shot in his bag throughout the 48 minutes of the game until this year. He seems to be, "I don't want to take that shot." And if you look at the usage rate in clutch situations this year, guess on the Lakers who has the number one usage rate in clutch situations, game within five, final 5 minutes, it's LeBron, not Luka Doncic, right? It is a weird thing, right? The fact that he turned down this shot, something that we've always grilled LeBron for, is turning down this shot. But this wasn't like he was making the smart play. It was he was not increasing the odds and moving the needle towards a higher percentage shot in this instance. This is not the classic LeBron James kicking out to the corner for whether it's Chris Bosh or Rashard Lewis, Shane Battier, Ray Allen in the corner. This is a grenade. this was a flaming bag of, you know, what was it? It was Billy Madison, the flaming bag of dog poop in the on the front step. That's what LeBron was giving or getting here from Luka Doncic. So you can't argue that he was making the smart play like LeBron always did down the stretch. All right, so I dug this up, and I wanted to bring this up here. According to StatHead.com, the last two seasons, Dan, okay, over the last two seasons, there have been 207 players who have made a shot in the final minute, shot to tie or go ahead. So in that instance, 6 seconds left, down one, Luka Doncic had the shot to win the game, to go ahead, or to at least tie, right? There's been so many instances that we've seen the Lakers or the Mavs or whomever in this in the last 2 years. Jalen Brunson has 12 makes in this instance. Again, final minute of the game, fourth quarter overtime, shot to take or tie or lead. He has 12 makes over the last two seasons. Tyrese Maxey has 12. Jalen Brunson has 12. Tyrese Halliburton is 10 for 12 in this situation. I'm just naming these guys.
I remember us talking about that, yeah.
It's just these guys are have been awesome in these situations. So of the 207 over the last two seasons that have made this shot, where do you think Luka Doncic ranks in that group of 207?
In total makes? Let's say like 15th.
Okay. What if I told you, Dan, that he does not have a single make? He is not among those 207.
Wow. That would surprise me a great deal.
Yeah, he's 0 for 5 in that situation. And last on Tuesday night, where he's turning down the shot to hand the grenade off to LeBron, that's been indicative of Luka over the last 2 years, just hasn't been willing to take that shot. And he hasn't made a single shot. And he's not one of 207 players to hit one of those shots down in those late situations, down to to tie or to take the lead. He hasn't made a single one of those shots, and 207 other players have. He's 0 for 5 in those situations, and he hasn't taken a single shot this year. In that situation, LeBron has 3 shots. Rui Hachimura has 2. And I believe it's Austin Reeves has 2 to his name. And Luka Doncic has 0 as a Laker this year in that situation that we saw on Tuesday night. So, Dan, you can't just chalk this up and say this was a one-off. Like, he just short-circuited. It seems like Luka, in these moments over the last 2 years, has either shied away from these moments or just has decided, I can get a better shot for someone else in these moments. And I will point out, LeBron did get a great inbounds pass there in the closing minute from Luka at the rim. And so there are moments where Luka is making the smart play to increase the chances that his team can get a great shot. This was not one of those instances. And the fact that Luka Doncic, widely considered one of the best players, if not the best player, has not made a shot in the final minute with a shot to tie or to take the lead is outrageous. I was shocked to learn this morning when I was digging up the numbers, how often this instance happens and how often Luka actually makes that shot. Those buzzer beaters that I mentioned hasn't happened in 5 years. Okay. Hasn't happened in 5 years. So Dan, with what you were mentioning about the weirdness of him saying it was too far away, I think it does raise the question if he's conditioned enough or he has his legs enough to take those shots with confidence. Because clearly, if 207 players have that shot in their bag over the last 2 years and you haven't, there's something to that.
Which is wild, because I think when we think of late game Luka, like the image in my brain is him saucing up Rudy Gobert to like end that playoff series, right? But that's a few years ago too, and that's a different situation. And so, yeah, it was also notable to me that when they were asked about it, both JJ Redick and LeBron James were like, "We executed." I think LeBron did the interview at his stall. It wasn't at the podium, but I think he said we executed like 5 times in about a minute and a half in the answering those questions. Like, you know, you got to ask Luka what he saw on that. I thought he had a good look, just looked like he kind of lost his balance, you know, didn't have a rhythm with the ball, whatever the case may be. You know, but like, I thought we had a good opportunity. He came off clean and I think he felt off balance. We executed, we didn't get the shot we wanted. Like, In the last segment, we talked about disconnect, right? The idea, like, there's a disconnect between what the stats say and what your eyes tell you. Something feels a little disconnected in LA. And, like, zoom out, just, like, take a look at the state of affairs there. They are now in sixth place in the Western Conference, 34-23. They're two games up on Phoenix ahead of the play-in tournament right now. They're probably fine in that because, as we mentioned earlier, Phoenix dealing with the injury to Devin Booker. Dylan Brooks broke his hand. The offense has basically died in Phoenix without those guys being available. So, like, their likelihood of staying in sixth and avoiding the play-in is pretty good. We mentioned some of those prediction models earlier. Impredictable has them about 85% at finishing top six. ESPN has them at 70%. Dunks and Threes about 64%. Basketball Reference 55, so closer to a coin flip that they're going to stay up above the play-in. But, like, that's fine. Staying out of the play-in is fine. I don't think that's the goal anybody had for the Lakers coming into this sort of situation. And we are talking about a team that, again, they're 11 games above 500. They have a negative point differential for the season. The Lakers are minus 21 on the season. And they're down to 11th in offensive efficiency outside of garbage time. Like, the things that were supposed to carry this team are not carrying this team. And I like this as just like a snapshot of where we are, right? So we love going to pbpstats.com, our buddies over there. They have that, as you mentioned earlier, the with or without you lineup data. You can see how a team fares with different sort of configurations of players on the floor. You look at every version of Luka, LeBron, Austin Reeves. Only two of them, and again, this is going back to last season, so back to when Luka got traded, the trade that landed him in LA. Only two configurations have consistently performed well. There's Luka and Austin Reeves without LeBron. That's plus 12.6 per 100 possessions. And there's LeBron without Luka and Austin Reeves. That's plus 7.2 points per 100 possessions. And that kind of feels like it, right? There's two teams. There's the team that was there before Luka got there, and there's the team that's not going to have LeBron on it. And they're just kind of stuck between those two teams right now, it feels like. And that's been true narratively. It was true with the Rich Paul stuff this summer. It's true with what they did or did not do with the trade deadline. It's true with the uncertainty about where LeBron goes after this season. It's all of it feels like you're sort of stuck between stations here. And sometimes when you get stuck between stations, you got somebody that's scratching the record, pulling the shot down, and then passing it off to somebody else, and no one's exactly sure what to do. So we executed. We didn't get the look we wanted. Many such cases in LA.
Yeah, the weird thing is, right, again, this episode is talking about conflicting narratives, conflicting information that you think it's one way, but it's actually another. And if you just step back and you look at the clutch numbers for the Lakers, they're 16-4 in clutch games. So they are, by record, the best clutch team in the NBA. But a lot of those is when they're leading in the clutch, like when they're plus four, plus five in the final 5 minutes, and then they make a run at the end of the game, and it's a W for those clutch situations. When they're down in those situations, a lot of times they just aren't as good, but they haven't had a lot of those. If you're following the Lakers this year, they're kind of this weird team that they're always like getting blown out, or they're blowing out the opponent. And in the times that it has been close, it hasn't really lucked out in the way that we did on Tuesday. On Tuesday, it didn't work out in their favor. But so far this season, they're 9-3 in games in which it's a one possession game in the final minute, and they're 16-4 in the final 5 minutes, game within five. And so maybe we're just making a mountain out of a molehill here on this one possession. Sure. But again, this has happened time and time again in these clutch, super ultra clutch moments where Luka is either passing it off or he's just not taking the shot. And he hasn't made one. He's 0-5. And it's just uncharacteristic. We watched him early in his career just killing people, being an assassin in these late game-winning scenarios. And it's been a long time since he's done it. And I don't know what that's about. But hey, that's why we're going to continue monitoring this and keeping an eye on it and parsing these quotes from LeBron where he's like, I'm pretty sure we got a good look there. And the whole weird Austin Reeves, LeBron, and Luka, it's just not a winning formula. I think it is very much ominous. I think it's ominous that they do not mix well together. They are oil and vinegar out there together. And the fact, I think it was Tim McMahon on ESPN this morning was like, they're minus 82 on the floor together, Luka and LeBron, which is the worst plus minus for any duo on the Lakers. So not great.
I mean,
not great. And it goes into what you were saying earlier. It's just like, there's two teams. It's Luka and Austin Reeves. And then there's LeBron when he's the unquestioned alpha out there. Those are the two really good Lakers units. But putting them together, not great. So another tough one for the Lakers on Tuesday night. And I think we're seeing that Luka Doncic is fading from the MVP conversation. And that moment, I think, is going to stick in our brains as we move down to the end of the season. Dan, any last thoughts here on your return to the show? I feel like we had our legs beneath us in this one.
Absolutely. I felt strong. I felt rested. My only one, honest, I do actually have one thought, which was nice screen, DeAndre Ayton. DeAndre Ayton did a real nice job. He stuck Anthony Black on that screen. He gave Luka a window. It was like left tackle pass pro picking up the blitzer off the edge. He did a really nice job there. And I don't think we shout out DeAndre Ayton enough. That's right. And we don't shout him out enough. And when we do, it's often sarcastic. So I wanted to say, like, legitimately, good screen, DeAndre Ayton. Way to go. Yeah, that. But outside of that, it is wonderful to be back with you. I'm excited for the stretch run. And I had a great time today. I hope you did as well.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to the squad, Brad, Emmy, Sarah, Ryan, who have been doing great behind the scenes working on this show. Remember, a reminder to everybody, if you haven't done it yet, go subscribe to the YouTube channel, the new Yahoo NBA YouTube channel. That is Yahoo NBA. That's where you can find this show, as well as the Kevin O'Connor Show and the Dunker Spot. Always great to have a home for all our great analysis here at Yahoo Sports. So go subscribe there and get our latest content at our YouTube channel. And go subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us a 5-star rating. And as Bomani Jones likes to say, if you don't give me a 5-star rating, I am going to call you a hater. So we don't want to do that here on this show. But you know what? Desperate times come for desperate measures. If you're not giving us a 5-star rating, we are going to call you a hater. No, all
but
love,
if you do give us a 5-star rating, if you gave us a 5-star rating, Tom's going to call you big dog. And trust me, it feels real good.
Big dog. It's been great to have you back. Great show today. And everyone, be safe. And we'll talk to you next week.